Hi everyone, welcome. Here we are at our final curriculum call. What? Anyone else going, oh, that went way quicker than I was expecting. Yeah, me too. So a couple of things to let you know about. Actually, I can stop the share while I tell you this. Couple of things to let you know about is, and Scott's made it, he's in Europe at the moment, which is amazing. Next Tuesday at 5 p.m, Scott is going to be running a call which is all about certification as a self-belief coach, what happens after we complete our curriculum together, what we have a graduate support program that's just completely available to you. You're able to participate in that as much as you wish. So Scott's going to go into the details for that next week, so you feel kind of supported as we kind of cross over from the sort of learning part into more of the implementation part. And we have a final call after this one on the 27th of September, which is our closing circle. And I just highly recommend that you come to that, particularly and especially if you find endings a bit tricky. Right, because we do that in a really conscious way, and it's just a really good experience to have. I think it honors all of us and our time together. Yes, we'll make sure we record that call with Scott, so you're all good. But yeah, so do come along to these last few calls. It's going to really just help you kind of, I guess, process where we're at and all of that stuff, no matter how big or small that feels to you. Okay, so here we are at module 10. This call is going to be kind of chat heavy, right? So you're encouraged to ask your questions if you have them about the curriculum. I want to today just do a check-in as usual, revisit the aims of this module, and then talk a bit about the change cycle and from Prochaska and De Clemente, and then talk about how this can inform bringing all of this work together into a kind of coaching offer. I want to make myself available for any and all of your questions if you have any. So we'll go where we go. All right. So just check in from practice pods, from your client work, from anything that is coming up for you. Right now, opening it up. How did you get on with maybe putting in place a courage-based plan? Hey, Fiona.
Hi. Mine is sort of a comment, really, that in, I can't remember which call it was, one of the calls in module 9 about the compass, I had this like mind blown moment where you were like, yeah, so to help people move on, you need to go one round the circle to work on developing that resource. And my clients have been loving it, loving it, loving it. And all of a sudden, loads of people are getting amazing results. And they're like, oh, right, self-acceptance. Don't have much of that. Let's go. Let's go. And then all of a sudden their critics are like really calming down and moving over. And it just,
yeah,
I don't know. I feel like that one piece of information has like unlocked so many good things for me in the last couple of weeks. So yeah, thank you for that. I'm so glad.
And, you know, Scott's thinking around this model that I've developed really helped me to make that connection. So when Scott was doing his certification essay, he was fancy pants. And he joined everything up for me and explained it in a way that I hadn't thought of. And I was just like, you're a freaking genius. This is brilliant. And it's really helped me to see, oh, this is the way in. So I've always had this, and this might sound a little bit, I don't know, interesting. I feel like this whole model has been kind of given to me by something outside of me. So I've been putting all of these pieces together and figuring this stuff out, but this model of a compass, that has felt like the universe just went, oh, that's your work in the world. Here you go. And it came to me almost fully formed. And then I have just been working it all out and learning more about what it means and how it looks and all of that stuff. And just to give you a little insight into my world, a client of mine is a shaman and in her 70s. And she said, oh, this is like the compass that you're teaching me. That's very familiar to me, because in shamanic practice, there is this kind of like the north, the south, the east, the west. That is a very kind of, and they all have different qualities and things like that. So I think something in there got kind of shared. I don't know how that happened, but yes. So I'm excited. I was very excited to make that discovery. So Rowena, what Fiona's mentioning is I'm going to share the model with you, because that would be super easy for me to do. Just to bring this to life, it will make it really, really obvious very quickly.
I have it set as the background on my PC. So anytime I'm talking to clients, I just share my whole screen and go to my background. You have home screen and it's just there.
You've gone full brainwash. I love it so much. Love it so much. Okay, let me share this with you. Sorry, give me 1 second to just find it on my drive. Here it is. Okay. Share screen. I love this technology. How amazing. Okay, so when you look at this model, so what when we're talking about the different aspects of the compass, if you've got a really strong critic, right, the way we want to experiment with interrupting that critic and healing it is to move to self-acceptance. So it's all about working with imperfection and acknowledging your emotions and needs. To heal that martyr pattern, we want to move to self-worth. So we give people a sense of they can take up their own space, have boundaries, advocate for themselves. Yeah. And likewise with the scapegoat, it's all about making decisions, keeping promises to yourself. And with the bystander, helping them to connect to the wider vision and goals of their work, their experience, their lives, like why are you doing this for, helps them to kind of get out of that stuck place. It's not a perfect science, it's not a formula, but I agree, I found that too, Fiona, that clients will say, oh, when I start doing this, it's like I'm, and the aim, right, when we're working with these protectors, the aim is to help the client experience a sense of internal safety, right? That's actually really healthy. Whereas when the protective pattern is at play, it's like I've found this is a survival strategy that has helped me feel safe, but it is protective in nature. It actually holds me back. Whereas we want the client to experience a sense of safety that is healthy, that actually allows them to do their things in the world. So it's all about helping them navigate that link between a sense of risk and a sense of safety. Right, knowing that the critic can't do enough to feel safe, the martyr can't give enough to feel safe, the scapegoat can't quit enough to feel safe, and the bystander can't wait long enough to feel safe. Like the safety is a kind of myth. It's one of those things where we tell ourselves this will happen when, but actually it's not true. So we want to help our clients to develop a really healthy sense of safety so that no matter what happens, they're okay. Does that make sense? Yeah, cool. Really cool. Yeah. Yeah, Fiona.
So after you said that and I was like, okay, right, something just shifted for me. I sort of was curious about the setup of the diagram. And if the resource that soothes the critic is actually self-acceptance, why is the critic lined up to self-belief?
Because the critic is a shadow of self-belief.
So once you've used self-acceptance to like unlock that resource, then what comes into fruition is actually then they can have their vision and
goals. Correct. And leadership and yeah. impact. Okay.
So it's like if you think about each of these compass points as a way of understanding more about the client's world, their meaning making. When self-belief is really high, it's likely that their critic is going to be much smaller, right? But when their critic is big, it's because that self-belief hasn't developed. Mm-hmm. But it is a kind of system. It's an interactive thing. Like we all have all of these things, right, in different proportions. And so when we're trying to, so the critic's like, I can't do enough to be safe, right, to really feel that safe. So if we were going to interrupt that by saying, well, get on with your vision and goals and leadership and encourage yourself, it can exacerbate that shadow because it is a kind of inverse relationship with that protective pattern. Do you see what I mean? So we need to do something different. And that's why moving around the compass helps us to interrupt that pattern, right? And it helps you to see how they're all connected, right? So for anyone, because most of us have more than one protective pattern, sometimes it's an under functioner and an over functioner, but it may be a different combination. The idea of seeing this as a kind of holistic model helps you to see that there isn't really like a formula, like it's not really a kind of this plus this equals that. But what I've found is that by interrupting that critic with more self-acceptance has a much more powerful impact than by trying to be better at self-belief.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Thanks, Sess.
Does that make sense? Yeah?
Yeah, makes perfect sense.
Yeah, cool. Really cool. And I think, honestly, I think that's why, you know, a lot of that kind of mainstream coaching stuff of you're lacking this, so you need more of that is kind of misses the point. There is a really good reason why we're lacking that. And if we just try and add on the thing that we think we're lacking, we miss what's actually caused it. We miss so much about what is truly needed to heal that thing. And we just end up in that place of controlling behavior and managing our mindset, which is, as we all know, a bit difficult, and it's never really robust. Yeah. Yeah. Iris. Hi, love.
Hey, I have two questions. So I totally get that for the critic, the self-acceptance piece makes sense. So I'm wondering about what the antidote is for the scapegoat. I think it was something like keeping promises to yourself. So I was wondering if you could say something more like just to clear it or like make it come alive. Because in my mind, I'm like, oh, they're struggling to keep promises. So do we just make them small? So that's okay, one cool. question I have. And the other one is that, okay. Maybe.
Shall we start there and then we come back to your next question? So yeah. So the idea is that you interrupt one pattern by going around the compass clockwise, right? So with mm-hmm. the scapegoat, right, the scapegoat is all about everything is too hard. I should just quit, right? It's too hard. Mm-hmm. Don't try. That's the safest thing to do is to not try. So what we want to do to interrupt that is to lean into self-trust. You can trust yourself, right? You can make decisions and you can keep promises to yourself. You can know what you need to do next. You can have that perspective, right? So all of those things. So whenever I'm getting someone to experiment with healing that scapegoat pattern, it's always about giving them the experience of completion, right? Because they are usually in that place of everything's too hard. I can't start a damn thing. Right. So what we want them to do is complete something, and it should be the smallest, easiest, most doable thing. So something like tidying a drawer, the drawer of doom in your kitchen that's got like all the important documents and string and pens that don't work. Right. Have the experience of tidying that and feeling organized, feeling like, OK, that's one thing I'm in control of, I've completed today. That can almost be like a gateway drug into, I don't have to quit. I can do things, right? Because that scapegoat often has a little bit of chaotic energy where you just feel overwhelmed. So we want to give people the experience of, no, you can trust yourself to do something.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. So it doesn't have, I guess the important thing is that it is a promise they can really keep. And so that means either model or making it something that is not scary. And then I guess reflecting on the fact that, oh, you look, you did something. Is that right?
Exactly. So all of these things are about thickening that narrative, right? That very thin story that says, don't try, be perfect, wait, mm-hmm. right? Overgive. I'm not as important as everyone else. All of these kind of thin stories that our protectors come up with, we want to thicken that narrative to make it more complex, right? So when someone says, I'm overwhelmed and I can't do anything, that's quite a thin story. When you give them that thing and say, okay, can you tidy a drawer just as we're talking? Even just while we're doing, I've done this before with someone who was like really in it and said, okay, I just want you to have the experience of completing something before we finish our session. So open your top drawer of your desk, show me the contents of it, you know, and it was a shit show. I'm like, okay, just take everything out and we're just going to organize it, throw out anything you don't need and then put what you do need back in. So she could have the experience. Okay, so now you've just created evidence that you are able to complete something, to be organized. How are you feeling about nothing works, it's all too much? And it was like, oh, I can't hold on to that as tightly anymore, right? I've started to thicken that narrative. I've started to change that story. It's like, okay, so let's go back to the thing that is causing that overwhelm. What's the smallest, most doable step? What's the drawer that you can organize around that, right? So it's really just about helping people get set up to take action that is from their healthy adult self, right? Mm-hmm. Equally, you can look at the beliefs around it. You can, you know, there's many different tools that you could use to interrupt people's stories. But I think experimentation is defo the where it's at, because you've then had not just a new belief, but an actual experience of something shifting for you. And it's hard to argue with that.
Yeah, that makes sense. Thank you. Okay, so then my other question was about self-belief and self-trust, because for some reason, I often still don't really understand what the difference is between them. So yeah. The self-worth and the self-acceptance, that feels very, I can kind of picture that. But for the self-trust and the self, like especially the self-belief, I get confused by. So I know that I think self-trust is a lot about basically trusting yourself that you can make decisions and that you can move forward and that it's okay. And then self-belief, so that in my mind also has to do with a vision. But then I thought self-belief is also about having that fire in the vision. But for some reason, I kind of can't feel them. I don't really understand what the difference is between the two.
Great question. Yeah, completely. So yes, exactly right with self-trust. That is, and remember, this has, if it helps you to remember, this has the element of air attached to it, right? So it's all the thoughty mm-hmm. stuff, the perspective mm-hmm. stuff, right? So the things that are quite hard to hang on to, intuition, intellect, perspective, right? Making a decision, all of that is connected with self-trust. But how do you know that the decision is the right one for you? That's connected to what's the point of all of this? Like, why do you feel compelled to make this decision in the first place? It's because you have some sort of vision for this part of your life, even if it's really unformed or a bit foggy, right? So self-belief is about, do I believe in my vision, in my ability to lead myself, right? It's the sovereign. So sovereignty is all about that self-determination. Do I believe in my ability to envision something for myself, like set intentions and then follow through on it, right? And the way I'm thinking about this, it's the fire in the belly, right? So it's what we conjure within us to allow that vision to happen. So it's the vision itself, it's the encouragement and support we give ourselves, right? It's all of that. And it's connected to all of the other compass points because, you know, in order for our vision to feel meaningful, it's usually about, you know, how we belong to ourselves, how we connect to other people, what we need, what how we feel about it, all of those things. It, to know which action to take, how much space to take up, to, you know, say no to other things, that's all about self-worth. And then to know which decisions to make, what perspective to take, how we can trust it. This is the decision that's in service of that vision, that comes from self-belief.
Okay.
So I think self, I mean, the reason that my work is kind of connected with self-belief is because to me that is at the top, right? That is without self-belief, without that vision, that sense of this is what I'm here to do, this is my purpose, this is the meaning and the fulfillment that I get, right, from whatever area of our lives. So we might have a vision for our family set up. We might have a vision for our work, for our business. We might have one for our romantic partnership, right? Like, this is my vision for this. This is what that means to me, right? And the way we know what decisions we're making that are in service of that is we're relying on self-trust to help us make those choices. So it is very connected, but it's a way of just delineating the two, the four, so that you can kind of interrupt the patterns of protection that hold you back in specific places.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the self-belief is more like, I guess, a calm knowing where you're going or what you're doing. And then the self-trust is more the day-to-day, trusting that you can know what needs to happen so that you get to that vision. Is that an accurate thing to say?
Well, just picking up on Fiona's metaphor of a destination in mind, right? We know where we're going because we have self-belief, right? Mm-hmm. That's the destination we've got in mind. How we get there is down to like self-worth. I've got to get in a car and I'm going to go and I'm going to take that action. Self-trust is the bit that says, do I take the train or a car? Do I go this direction or that direction? Do I stay overnight? Right. What actually serves me here? What are the choices I have here? And how can I do that?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I am not 100% clear yet, but I am okay. Clearer.
Yeah. Can I ask, Iris, when you think about your protective patterns, mm-hmm. where do they sit? Like your protectors?
Critic and scapegoat most.
Right. Okay. So actually the playing with self-trust would really support you, I think. Right. And it can just be very simple, like using the body compass, right? Like just tuning into what feels like a yes, what feels like a no for you is a way of really playing in that self-trust, like without consulting anyone else or asking anyone's advice. Checking in with yourself first and going, okay, what do I want for lunch today? You know, what are my choices? What feels good to me? So you're just kind of allowing yourself to trust yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. So almost to practice making choices, and that alone is helpful for both of them.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, because you're going to be that's a really great way to heal up that scapegoat pattern, right? Because you're going to be making choices. And, you know, it's literally like, what do I want to watch on Netflix? What do I want for lunch? Like low risk experiments here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also going to help you with the critic because you're going to be choosing things. And as you start to build your capacity to make decisions and choices, you're going to start to see, oh, and then when I make bigger choices, like bigger decisions, ones that have a bit more kind of weight to them, right? It's like, oh, the way I make those choices is because it's connected to some kind of vision I have for my life, mm-hmm. some area of my life.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. Perfect. Cool. Thank you. Great questions. I love it. Love it. Love it. Love it. Yes. The North Star for self-belief is a great one. Martha Beck's book about something to do with the North Star is quite a good read. I find her writing way less impressive than her in person, but it's all right. It's a bit sort of life coachy, you know, how sometimes, yeah. I can be a bit judgy about life coachy books, she says as she writes one. So, yeah, it's worth a look because it's very much about that vision for your life, how you know where you're going. Cool. Great questions, guys. Love it. Anything else on the compass so far? All good? Okay. All right. Let's revisit the aims of Module 10. Just to come back to where we're going here. And this is really about achieving goals, supporting our clients to achieve goals, right? Make changes, whatever that looks like for them. We kind of get that there's no right, linear, ideal way to do this. And we help our clients to feel resourced whenever the shit goes down, right? So to carry on with Fiona's great metaphor of just going on a journey somewhere, it's like, I always think about when you're traveling to a holiday destination, imagine if you got a flat tire. Would you just go, oh, that's it, the universe doesn't want this for me, and just pack up and go home, abandon the car? Because that's what a lot of us do, right? When our setbacks arise, we just go, oh, well, I guess that's it. We don't think, you know, who can I call? Who can help me? The AA. You know, how can I just get that tire changed? And then we just keep going, right? So it's that kind of thing. We're planning for those setbacks. What will you do when something inevitably happens? And we're always kind of keeping our eye on the big prize, right? Which is that the meta purpose of achieving any goal, realizing any dream, is what this does for the client's self-concept, how they expand to become the person who cannot now go back to being someone who hasn't achieved this goal. Right, you can't unring that bell. Once you've kind of made something happen, who you are changes. Who you become along the way is absolutely what matters. And we're always kind of advocating for the client's growth, not their goals. So we talked about this a bit last week, right? How we wanted to stay pretty detached from what the client wants to do, because we don't want to set up a relationship dynamic where they think we're more invested in their goals than we are, where they think something's at stake in our relationship, in our coaching relationship, because they feel they're failing, right? Equally, if they achieve them, we're like, groovy. Nothing's changed in terms of our respect and love and care for that client, but equally, we're interested in their growth. We're interested in who they've become along the way. That's the bit that's interesting. Not that they've achieved the thing. So the kind of main tool that we use for this is developing a courage-based goal, which leads to a plan, which helps the client to take action. And I think that each of these stages have their own challenges, right, for different clients. So it's one of those things where I highly recommend testing this process out with yourself, with a few clients. You may even want to sort of offer this it's a great like single session offer, right? To say, hey, have you got a goal that you're fascinated by, want to achieve, want to play with your self-doubt around? Come hang out with me for a couple of hours and we'll set one up for you and then have some action-based check-ins along the way, right? And that way you get to support your clients through their self-doubt coming up. It's inevitably going to come up because they are taking action on something that matters to them. That's where our self-doubt comes up. So it's the perfect playground for this work. Yeah. So I just want to kind of check in with folks around this approach How is it landing for you? Like this idea of just courage-based plans and goals and actions. Yeah. Please feel free to share.
I love it. It's my new favorite thing. I'm like, I'm never using any coaching tools ever again. This is it.
That's hilarious. Yeah. Yeah. Cool. I'm so glad. Have you used it? Have you used it yourself yet, Fiona, or started using it?
Yes, I've got a sticker chart to prove it.
Woohoo! Yay. Yeah.
And a very extensive list of actions.
Nice. Nice. Yeah. Very cool. Yeah. Very cool. I think once people get their head around this idea of it not being linear, then that seems to be the challenge. And sometimes people get caught up on the complexity of, well, how do I show if it's a, you know, if it's a challenge or a belief I want to believe along the way, or, you know, if it's a plan for a setback. It's like different coloured sticky notes, right? Like, it doesn't matter. You could have it in a different file. The point is that you use it, right? That's the difference between this and other planning tools, is often people will plan, but then the plan gets shelved and they never come back to it. Or the plan doesn't reflect reality, so it doesn't feel helpful when those setbacks occur.
I used it with a client yesterday who was very... like her, a lot of her actions that she came up with were really like in her head, like, oh, well, I could think about this or I could think about that. And so I really had to encourage her to sort of be more action oriented. And so we've ended up with more kind of make lists or have record cards or, you know, sticky notes and those kind of things to be more, just more sort of tangible actions rather than percolating.
I think that is a trick to doing that, is what Fiona, and it's that thing of getting people to get almost move beyond the thoughts and the feelings, right, into what does that look like then? How does that manifest itself into an action? Because, and the reason that's important is because it's when we document the action, we can check in with then how do we feel about that, right? Because if there's a ton of resistance, it's like, oh, we need to break that down a bit. So people will often, I think it's a protection mechanism that's quite sort of snazzy, actually. If I keep it in my head, right, if I never write it down, I never have to look at it. I never have to check in with how I feel about it or to face the resistance that it might bring. So, yeah, exactly what you're suggesting, just doing that work of pulling it out a little bit and seeing what looks like. And I think giving clients that support in the first few weeks of their plan is really important, because we almost want to prepare them for the inevitable thing, something won't go to plan or they won't feel like it or whatever. And it's like, here's what to do instead of that. Yeah. Once people start using this, though, and they kind of get into the rhythm of it, I think that's when it shows its worth. Yeah. But yeah, I've had lots of folks who that I've shown this to, taught this to, coached them through, that have just gone, oh, this is it. This is the way to do something. Gantt charts are dead to me, which is great. Yeah, so fun. So all I would say is, practice this for yourself. I think it's a great tool to use for your own business goals as well. And something we offer in the graduate support program is Susan Sutherland, who's one of the first class graduates. She runs a monthly call called the Creation Station, and we basically use courage-based planning. And you can just join. It's like a monthly call. You can just jump on in, and you can use it as a co-working experience to kind of use this tool and seek support, all that jazz. So it's a really fun way to sort of bring it to life for yourself. All right, so unless anyone has any more questions about courage-based planning, you're all good. I wanted to just talk a bit about changes for our clients. Something I've been thinking about quite a lot as I'm bringing our program to life for people. And the difference between giving folks information and supporting them to apply that information, right? How different that actually feels, right? So I just wanted to talk a little bit about what does it mean to actually make a change in your life? I thought it might be fun, but there's only four of us, so let's do this together. I thought it might be fun to do breakout groups. But I want you to all think about a change that you've made in your life. So it might have been like a like something you gave up or something you started doing, something that might be health related, but it may actually just be a belief you started believing. It could be anything, right? What's a change you've made? And I just want you to start to think about how you made that happen. And just like, let's open up the discussion. Please feel free to just unmute yourself and share. Okay, so what happened? What did you have to do to make that happen? Who wants to share first? Please don't feel you have to get it perfectly. Thought through before you share. Yeah, Scott.
I'll go first. You know, a big thing that changed for me was actually me doing my group program that you and I did this process together with, because I think the belief that I had before was that group programs are like successful group programs are things that other successful coaches did, and that was too complicated for me.
Yeah.
To be able to really wrap my head around it and do it successfully and market it successfully and all of that. So that was a big one.
And so tell us about what did you need to do to make that change? Like just riff on it.
Yeah. So I think the biggest thing was probably getting out there and actually declaring it to people.
Yeah.
Right. That sort of made it real for me, because then now it's like there's like skin on the line. You know, if I don't do this, people are going to know about it. And then also just the steps to market it really, really helped to create it. But I think I also had a belief that I needed to have it really buttoned up before I even went out there with people. So I just threw that out the door and was like, I'm just going to figure it out as I do it, which was actually really nice. So I just like gave that up. And then I just started marketing this program that I hadn't even created yet. And then all these people just started coming in and showing interest in that. I think it was in the doing of it, really, that made the change.
Yeah. What do you remember believing about the program to get out there and do the marketing?
The biggest thing was that it wasn't a big deal.
Right.
It was just an experiment. Like, just going to see what happens. Like, I was making it mean so much. It was so heavy. Yeah. And yeah, that it was just paralyzing me. So it's just really, I just gave it up. I was like, yeah, let's just have fun. Let's see what happens.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. Love it. I think one of my favorite beliefs to think, I don't know how people feel about this one, is one day I'm going to die. Like, I literally think that a lot, and it helps me to get out of that paralyzed space. Yeah, one day I'm going to die. Like, what? How am I going to feel if I'm lying somewhere going, oh, this is it, and I didn't do that thing? I'm going to be so pissed at myself. Yeah. Love it. Love it. Thank you, Scott. It's such a cool example. Anyone else want to share a change they've made in their lives? Yeah, Iris.
I would say maybe one of the hardest things I ever did was finish my thesis in psychology, and it took me 2 years instead of one what it was supposed to take. And I really resonated with what Scott said, because it had become this massive thing of this having to be super good and meaningful, and there was just a lot of expectations on this project. And it was the same as what Scott said, it only started to happen in the doing, and then just running up again and again against, I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to do this statistics thing. I don't understand that part of the theory. And only in doing that, and then also being more in touch with the supervisors, so that I had some accountability did it change or did I get to the finish line? But I actually thought something quite that is quite interesting is that it actually didn't change any of my beliefs. Like, we had this conversation in our practice pod or in being coached in the practice pod about how, you know, because of my scapegoat, I feel like I don't complete things. And I have a list of things I've completed in my life, including 2 degrees and that one massive thesis. But in my brain, I just, even though I completed it, it still felt like a failure, or I think it actually into the protector instead of feeding into something else, because I guess it just went unchecked. I was just trying to survive and trying to get it done. And then as soon as it was done, I was just like, let's just never think about this again. So yeah, that was just an interesting realization right now, because for Scott, it sounds like it was like, oh, cool. And now I'm growing and now I can do different things. And I've upgraded like my self-concept. And for me, it was very much like, oh, thank God that is over. We'll never do that again.
Yeah. Well, and it may, I don't know if this is true, but Iris, it sounds like completing that thesis, it's almost like it wasn't quite connected to your vision for yourself, or there's something about a value that wasn't honored in that process, maybe.
Yeah, it was that I was trying to make it, I was trying to marry my coaching self and academia, and that really didn't work very well because my supervisors were just not interested, if that makes sense. And so I constantly felt like I was getting things wrong with not being academic enough. And like the whole process of like feeling very left alone by my supervisors and like intense perfection and like myself, and then from my supervisors constantly moving the goalposts, what needed to be included was not helpful. And then and I think I made it all about me failing by procrastinating when I had very big life circumstance reasons that were a good reason for why this would take long as well. But I kind of swung between saying, oh, I can't possibly do this thesis because look at me being so depressed, and then going, but I shouldn't be completing it anyways because I don't know what.
It sounds like it has provided more evidence for your protector rather than your healthy self.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
So it may be, yes, academia speaks the language of the protector. I'm with you. I think corporate world does too, right? All of our survival strategies are highly prized in the corporate world. Don't feel too much, don't be too human, overwork, all of that shit. Believe that you're never going to be good enough. It's like fuel for productivity. So it would be interesting, Iris, to think about the changes that you've made, the things you have completed that fed your healthy self, right? To think about, like, what are you proud of that you've created? I'm thinking about your business.
Yeah. It is definitely my business. It's also the fact that I did do those 2 degrees because they were quite hard. And so that I got through them. So in the big picture, I guess I can see it as a healthy thing, a good thing. But then if I go back to specific memories of how I did that completing, it always feeds into that protector of, oh, that wasn't good enough. But yeah, I guess I'm realizing I really have a very strong belief that I don't finish things. So, or when I do finish something, I just move the goalpost and then we've got a new thing to feel bad about.
It's like the completion doesn't get integrated. So it doesn't fit that scapegoat. Yeah.
That's very much, I think, what is happening. It's almost like literally the day after I got that piece of paper that said, you're a psychologist now, I started a new part-time copywriting SEO job. Like I was just busy immediately.
So it's interesting, isn't it? Because it could be that part of integrating this achievement can happen now.
Yeah, true.
Right? Like, how would you use it? And I've just, you know, please don't feel like you need to share now, but it's that thing of how could I use what I know now to help me integrate these achievements?
Yeah.
If anyone has a strong critic, celebrating achievements can feel like a very foreign country we never visit. We don't go there. Yeah.
Sure. I think that is very accurate. I was trying to celebrate my degree and then I was like, what am I going to do? Get myself flowers? Like,
yeah,
go out and have a drink? Like, yeah. Like that's not going to,
yeah.
What's that going to change? So yeah, that really resonates.
And maybe there's like 100 things you need to do.
To celebrate?
Hmm.
That sounds interesting.
Yeah, like Rowena sounds like she's up for a party too. Right? Yeah. Yeah. Like, how can you celebrate? I remember when I finished my MA, my first action, I got the piece of paper through and it was like, I've been pre-approved for a doctorate program because I passed this thing. And I had the screen open to like apply, like to submit for the PhD. And Ash came into my office like with a cup of tea and a bunch of flowers or something. He's like, what are you doing, woman? And I said, well, I got in. And he's like, can we just take 5 minutes to celebrate? He's very good at this kind of thing. And he's like, there's no rush. And that has kept, I've kept trying to kind of tune in, when is the right time for me to carry on? Because I would love to. That's part of my vision for me is to finish a PhD, but there's no rush.
Yeah. No, that's a really good, I can relate to that a lot. And I think the, like, one thing that is very, I don't know if it's specific for me, but because I've just, you know, like, found out I'm autistic, ADHD, gay, and I was in an abusive relationship all in the span of a year.
Enough going on.
I know, but like, what definitely hasn't happened is each of those lenses of looking at my life means everything is completely different than what I thought. And then that times four. So yes. I think in many ways, what maybe is lacking at the moment is just integrating it into a new story or a new self-concept. Because right now, almost every time I look back at a memory, or it doesn't even matter what it is, I go, oh, that was because you were autistic, or that was because you were queer, or and that is very shaky, you know, when you're like, oh, I don't really understand what even happened. And I think that might have to do with the not celebrating as well, you know, like they're not integrating it, because it feels like everything's just shifting all the time still.
Yeah. Beautiful. I was going to say, Iris, I think of all of us, you've possibly had the most expansive self-concept changes over the last year than anyone could imagine. And that is all worth celebrating.
Yeah. And it feels like, I mean, it's a very good thing, you know, I'm very happy with these realizations and changes, but it's a lot. Yeah. And the whole self-doubt stuff is very helpful, but at the same time, it's also kind of just confusing sometimes to even acknowledge how much self-doubt there is when you know, I feel quite strong and I have a vision and all that, but at the same time, all of those individual lenses and experiences that I've had, each are like a field day for self-doubt. You know, when you're autistic, you don't trust your needs. When you're queer, you don't trust, and you're in a hetero relationship, you don't trust to know what's going on. And when you're abused, it's like a constant attack at everything. So, yeah.
I just really want to affirm, Iris, like, that you are here is miraculous. And everything that you've been through to get you to here, I just really want to acknowledge where you're at. Like, it is such an example of courage and of really being honest with you.
Thank you.
Yeah. And there's no rush. And I absolutely dare you to celebrate yourself every day.
Okay, I can just try.
So in tiny ways. right? Find things that delight you as you now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Just really acknowledging you, Iris. Really just a joy to witness you coming into yourself. Yeah. Awesome. This change business is like, it's tricky shit, isn't it? You know? You know, and as I'm thinking about this thing about what it means to actually make changes, the thing I always go back to in my own life is getting sober, which happened over 10 years ago and feels like a very small part of my life now. But in those first couple of years, I just felt like I was made of glass. And there was this sense of, like you say, Iris, like you look at your life through a different lens. And sometimes you're like, I don't even recognize the people around me, the job I'm in, the world I've created. Like, this doesn't fit me anymore. And now it's like everything has to shift, you know. So those big changes can be like not just an expansion of self-concept. It can be an identity shift. Sometimes, you know, more than one at a time. So I always come back to the courage that our clients show us when they say, hey, I really want to make this change and I have no freaking idea what I'm doing. And, you know, for us to be able to walk with them through that and help them to make sense of things in different ways is really just such a, I think, it's the best job in the world to be able to do that. And if we are coming at this from our own experiences of what it takes to make big changes in your life, even small changes in your life, like I just am thinking how celebrating things has been this quite, it feels like quite a small thing, just learning to celebrate, right? But actually it has radically shifted how I see my life, how much more optimistic I feel, how more aligned to my vision for my life I feel. So small or big changes, they take energy and effort, and it doesn't just, we don't just wake up the next day and go, ta-da, I'm different now, right? Like it happens over time with lots of almost little actions. Yeah, Rowena.
Yeah, just to pick up on that little actions point. I've started to, this is going to sound a bit strange, but diarize things I enjoy. So every week, Sunday, Friday, whatever, sit down, look at the week ahead and be like, right, what is the shit that Rowena enjoys? It's this, make myself a little list, shove it in the gaps. And that's because it was such an alien concept to kind of bring these things into my world and not fill them it with, you know, more work, more parenting, more all of that kind of stuff. So it felt like the most natural way for me to do it, to like block it out in my diary, to a point that I'm hoping it becomes normal and like natural. But when I've been doing it a couple of weeks, and it's made a huge difference to just my kind of day-to-day mood, I suppose, you know, because there's always something to look forward to. That's right.
Yeah.
So yeah, I spent two hours on a reservoir last night. It was great.
Amazing.
I've got a car. I can get in the car and drive there. Ta-da! And because it was written down and I just did it rather than going, oh, maybe might rain. You know, that kind of approach. It's down, I'm doing it, I'm gone.
And I love this so much. Iris Murdoch said it's like the secret to a happy life is small joys or something, or consistent small joys. And I think this is the stuff that I think our clients really almost like, I know I go, a small joy. That sounds like pointless, doesn't it? Right.
Yeah.
Because I'm very quick to judge myself. And actually, what you're saying, right, Rowena, is exactly what happens is when you go, yeah, it might rain, but I'm still going to go.
Yeah, did rain and it was ace. It was really nice, you know?
Rain will not stop you again.
Mm-mm.
And you have to have the experience of it to do that.
Yeah.
So making that change of a decision, so first of all, coming up with the list of things, writing down that you wanted to go to the reservoir, then coming to the last night and going, oh, it might rain, and still overriding that with, I'm going to go anyway, and then getting in the car and going. Mm-hmm. Right. So that one small joy required probably about 15 decisions, all self-trust. I'm trusting that my life of joy is on the other side of making all these decisions.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it was interesting when I was kind of first having an attempt at diarizing, and it was kind of after my like summer off and stuff, and I was thinking, right, I've got to get into this habit now before work forces its way in. And I was like, right, so maybe two nice things a week, is two a good number? I don't know. Then I was like, no, every day nice stuff, thank you very much, you know, we can't sort of. And yeah, anyway, that was my two penneth, but it really has helped. Immensely.
And I love what you're saying, Fiona, that actually when people say, I want a nice life, I want to be happier, don't want to feel so much self-doubt, just feel a bit like, life's a bit shit, or God, it's just so complex and tricky. It isn't become a millionaire. It isn't lose 100 pounds. It isn't, you know, all the things that we're told that we, you know, that is where happiness actually lies. For most of us, for most of our clients, that ain't it. And so it's almost like we have to deprogram and decondition ourselves from all of that shit and come back to, yes, dear client, but what's joy to you? What does it look like to you? You know, and at different ages and stages and contexts, that is going to look differently. But to make a change, when you just think about Rowena's evening in the reservoir, 15 decisions, right? But now something has changed. You can now not go back and not have that memory. So something's different for you, right?
And also I've like roped a friend in. So, you know, so you kind of can, you know, now we've got a bit of accountability, but it's not fixed, and we can, and it's okay if I fall off my paddleboard and 15 people see, never mind.
Yes. Beautiful. Yeah. Such a great example, right? And it's like, what does that unleash? I think that's the key thing, right? Is thinking about these smaller changes. What do they unleash? What do they allow us to do? What's different? Our self-concept begins to expand from that moment. So just before we end today, I just want to talk a bit about this model, which I think is just helpful, from Prochaska and De Clemente. It's used in a ton of different environments. It's very well established. But I just want to go through this from the context of your coaching practice, right? So our clients at pre-contemplation and contemplation, these are your newsletter followers and your Instagram followers. These are the people that are like, she seems all right, I'll follow her. He seems all right, give him a follow. They seem to know what they're talking about, right? Then at some point, they're going to go, oh no, actually that applies to me. You're speaking my language. So I'm contemplating something that is going to change in my life. If we don't keep showing up to people and sharing our stuff and helping them to, you know, get a kind of sense of what we do, how we can help, what's possible for them, we don't really give people the opportunity to make the connection between their experience and our work. So to me, these guys, these pre-contemplation guys, are your potential clients. Right. And as they become your kind of like actual clients, it means that they're moving into this phase where they're either trying action on their own or they're preparing to get in touch with us to say, hey, can you help me? So engaging in engaging with these folks, like making your newsletter, your social media, your whatever, however you communicate with people that may be your people. It may be that you run workshops and invite prospective clients in to have a small experience of your work. Like that sharing is really important because it leads to people making that connection. So we got to keep showing up. And at some point, our clients are going to say, all right, I can see that there is a connection. I can see that you could help me. And if we never actively invite people to come and chat about working with us, they might go, so I'll go and find a coach like you. A friend of mine says, like, the way to make money from coaching is to meet people and tell them you're a coach and then invite them to work with you. I'm like, yeah, that's, man, that took me a really long time to learn. Embarrassingly long time to learn, right? And the folks that are at that preparation action stage, when they become your new clients, right, the approaches we want to support them with, because they want to take action. They know that something wants to change, but they don't know why they can't make that change. They might not know what to do, right? So our tools that can support them are very much around the life map, mapping their protective beliefs, right? So they can see, oh, even though I want to do this, this is what I'm actually doing because I'm worried about that, and that's the protective belief, right? So the belief buster, the belief biography, all of that stuff. We're trying to help them understand why something feels too much, too risky, they're not capable. And as your clients have been working with you for a while, they're going to be in that place of actively changing what they're doing, what they believe about themselves and other people in the world, what they are doing as a result of that, how they feel about all of that. They're going to be going through that process in the courage-based plan where things don't work and they have setbacks, and can they come back from that? Can they keep going? What extra support might they need? It is a spiral, right? We kind of sometimes we can circle around the contemplation, preparation, action. That can become its own mini spiral. Like this whole idea that any model is a nice, neat, linear process is completely arbitrary. But if we don't keep kind of leading and saying what you're experiencing is totally normal, this won't go in a straight line, this takes time, everything you're experiencing is completely understandable, let's make sense of it, then our clients could just think, oh, it's not for me really, this change business. So as they are going through that spiral, part of our work is to help provide them with this model of a healthy self. Right? Sharing with them that, you know, whatever they do, we unconditionally believe in their capacity to make the shifts they want to make. It's reflecting and encouraging and working through the beliefs one at a time, all of that good stuff. Right? Until they do something like Rowena and they go to the reservoir and they're like, fuck me, I could have done this months ago, right? Or they show up on social media and they're like, oh, I can be visible. They do what you said, Scott, and they're like, I'm going to create this program in my business, or I'm going to make this change, I'm going to do this thing. And they have an experience, and I think the experience is really important because it gives them evidence that something has shifted. Then they're in this place of what else is possible. And I think we get out of the contemplation bit and into the prep and action bit. And when people are in this spiral, right, where it's just that constant kind of like, okay, what's next? Let me try the next thing. And even if that's not about productivity, right, the next thing might be, what's another belief I could practice? What's a belief I want to heal? What's something I want to change? How can I experiment in this protective pattern? Right? That's when the coaching gets really, really fun. Right? And so you have all of these tools to really support people to play with all of this. Those compass tools are going to be super exciting and useful to work through. And at some point, right, your clients are going to say, I'm good. I've got what I came for. I'm off. I'm in maintenance mode, right? And they'll go and try and take that action themselves, right? And then you might offer a group program or another way to work with you, or they might relapse and they'll be back because they already trust you. They've already had this great experience with you. And so we end up creating this, and I found this even after 3 years of not working with muggles, as I've been offering my new program, people have said, oh, Sass, I've been waiting for you to offer something. I'm in. So it's like you establish this relationship with people and they come back to play. And you're building this sustainable thing, right? You're building something that actually has real value for your people. It's a great thing, like I found, when you have those one-off sessions, those single sessions, for folks who've maybe gone through a long-term coaching relationship with you, to be able to say, hey, it's coming up to Christmas. Why don't you treat yourself to a one-off session and we'll start in the new year? Something to look forward to, Rowena. Right? It's like that's the trick, right? And this is the thing. You need to have offers available for people to buy. So whatever is holding you back from that, that's the thing to look at. And then as you get used to all of that, you start raising your rates and starting wait lists and all that jazz. But I think the important thing is to recognize that our clients are in all of this spiral. And our job is to sort of support them in that, to keep showing up for them in that, to not imagine that people are thinking things about us, because usually they're not at all. They're thinking about them and their experience and why they keep screwing up and not doing the thing they want to do, or why they feel stuck. And it's like an ongoing invitation. Anyone got any questions about how they are going to use these tools and implement them in their practice? Does that kind of land for you about that change cycle? I think it's a really helpful way of seeing what's required from us to lead our clients. Yeah. And, you know, what I would offer is, and I come back to the Belief Buster all the time, it's the tool I use the most kind of on myself, is what you believe is going to be what you create, because what you believe determines how you feel about it and then what action feels possible. So, and just to give you an example of this, over the last few weeks, I've been in this launch period and I could feel myself believing it's a recession, no one's going to want to buy this. The recession's coming, the winter fuel bill's coming, no one's going to want this. And I checked in with myself, okay, if I believe that, how do I feel? Yeah, I use it most in the middle of the night, love it. I was just feeling kind of defeated and sad and a bit like, ugh, like I can't, there's no energy to sell this, to invite people in. So because of that, I just felt like I can already feel myself pulling back from that invitation energy. And so I'm like, okay, I've got to do this work and find another belief or three that would be supportive, that are just as true, but are more helpful. Things that are not aspirational, right, but beliefs that I already believe. And the one I came up with was like something like the world is on fire, or something more sweary. The world is on fire. This is the time to back yourself, to trust yourself. And I'm like, oh, exactly what you're saying, Rowena. People will want to do this because of those things. Like I'm like, yeah, I already believe that. I totally believe that. So that made me feel quite motivated and excited and very much in that invitation energy. And, you know, and that has spurned me on to kind of keep showing up and to trust that my clients are smart. They'll know what's right for them. So all to say, whether you choose to believe it's a recession, no one's going to want this, or the world's on fire, now's the perfect time to trust yourself, whatever you choose to believe, it's true. Absolutely, both things are true, because lots of things are true at the same time. But you can choose to believe the thing that is the most helpful for you and allows you to have the most impact for your clients. And it's taken a really long time for me to get that and not feel like, is this freaking manifesting? Like, that feels gross, right? So it's not that, right? It's not about manifesting. It's what I already believe. I can choose to pour my energy into that. Yes, other things are true, but that's the thing that helps me the most. And that's then the action I take, the feelings I feel, the results I get. Hey, loves. I just want to throw it open. If anyone's got any other questions, any thoughts, anything they're thinking right now that you want to, you've got it. You've got the floor. Rowena, go for it.
Yeah, no, just to kind of echo what you said there, really, with an example, Charlotte and I were having a kind of mini pod session the other day, and she said to me, she was coaching me, and she said something along the lines of, you know, people need this. And if, you know, there is absolute evidence everywhere you look that people need this kind of important work. And I was thinking, crikey, if you see it like that, then it doesn't feel so sort of uncomfortable or self-doubty or make yourself small. It feels, oh crikey, got stuff to do, you know, want to get on with it. And it was just a real kind of small sense, feels urgent, definitely, and important and worthy, and not just some people having a chat, you know. And that was just a bit of a game changer for me.
Amazing. I think I love that example, because it really can be through that power of just someone reflecting back something that I think maybe is probably bubbling under the surface but may not be conscious, and then someone puts words to it and it's like, oh, I have an emotional response to that feels very aligned to the vision I have for my work, right? So it's almost like your self-belief gets involved then. Yeah. Amazing. Really cool. We've got work to do, folks. The world's on fire. Amazing. This has been a really fun session. I love that we had lots of chat. It was really cool. So this is being recorded and will be posted. We've got Scott's session next week and the closing circle the week after. You'll get some info for prep for your closing circle this week. Anything that isn't clear, just yell in the discussion forum and we'll get to it. But yeah, we'll see you. I won't be here next week, but I will see you in a couple of weeks for our closing. All right, loves, take care. Okay, see you soon. See you, Scott. Bye.
Thank you.